Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind's Guide for Spiritual Living. And the April theme is the attentive journey. You see what you look for. Uncaged in this moment. The sacred begins where you awaken to your own worth. Amina Wadud. It is not enough to say that God is. The concept must be brought home to the mentality of the individual and unified with it in order to have it expressed through them. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 183. What is spirituality? What is God? These two questions draw humans into seeking some kind of definitive answers for the journey of life. What is so fascinating is that it is us, our minds and consciousnesses, that we use to try to answer them. Historically, in this quest, when people feel a pull toward an answer, they create stories to try to encompass the all-encompassing. For some, these stories become the foundation of a book, and these books become the tools to enlightenment or salvation. As we continue this quest for these answers, many of us, myself included, seek stories and books written by others to help us on this voyage. These books become the roadmap to help us finally grasp the totality of the omnipotent. Many dive deeper into the books, memorizing passages, learning how to pray in a certain way, using a given book as the foundation on which they build their experience. All paths are sacred, and I respect each one. What I found for myself is that spirituality and God cannot be encompassed within a book. A book may point the way, but the book is not the way. Far too often, the book, once designed as a tool, becomes a cage that locks the infinite into a finite thought. When spirituality is uncaged, so too is the infinite God. Sometimes we must put down the books, clear our minds, and meet the infinite right where we are in this moment of now. Affirmation. God is, and I am. Connection builds peace. As long as we divide the world as you and me, conflict will continue. In the understanding of our shared humanity, peace begins. Jiddu Krishnamurti. Fear is the belief in limitation, a denial that the divine is the center and the source of all good. We must do all in our power to overcome it. Perfect love casts out fear. That is, confidence overcomes the depression of doubt. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 404. Wherever there is division, conflict slowly begins to swell. Therefore, conflict is the effect of division. In this time on planet Earth, it doesn't take too much energy to witness division. We see it in religion, in nations and borders. We see it in politics, even in the communities where we live. Some of these divisions create minimal issues, and others are the source of war, atrocities, genocide, and unimaginable levels of suffering. Yet all of them stem from the concept of division. We are equipped with a consciousness, a mind that can create nearly anything. It can create harmony, peace, love, opportunity, connection, and abundance. And we've been taught to use it, often unconsciously, to create and perpetuate division. I want to be very clear. I am talking about the world we are in. We can bypass this and solely talk about the universal oneness of all, and that is important. But we must use this idea of oneness to bring peace to this experience of now. How do we then rid the world of conflict? Simple. The answer is unity. Yes, we may be in different parts of the world. We may have been taught different philosophies. But we all are human, connected by God, by spirit, by the universe. Let us find unity with those we see as different and watch as division turns into connection, and connection builds peace. Affirmation. I am a unifier. I dissolve division by moving with a consciousness of unity. And again, I want to remind you that this month's daily selections were written by Jeffon Seely, JeffonSeely. I think he has some powerful things to share. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, grow. Spiritual living calls me to grow. It's exciting to know no matter my age, there will always be ways to grow and new experiences to have. Achieving a goal or realizing a dream does not signal the end of growth. Indeed, my successes call me to stretch and grow even more. With gratitude for all that has brought me to where I am, I prepare for my next pursuit. In prayer, I pause to discern what is next for me. I pray for inspiration and the zeal to act upon it. I then listen for my guidance and follow it, even if I find it surprising or a little daunting. This is how I grow, by pushing myself past comfort into new areas of discovery and endeavor. The world is wide and wonderful, and I have the spiritual gifts and divine inspiration to make my unique mark upon it. Inner peace. Secure in the presence of God, of Spirit, of the universe, I am peaceful and strong. I find comfort in knowing I am never alone, because God, Spirit, the universe is always with me and within me. Whatever I am called to face, I have inner resources to handle it peacefully. Peace dwells in the silence of my soul. When I feel troubled, I turn within. I breathe deeply and picture a peaceful setting, a trickling stream, the wind gently rustling the leaves, or the soft flicker of candlelight. I let tranquility sink deep into my heart. As I leave the quietness of prayer, I take peace with me. I am ready to face the day. As a peaceful person, I know that peace is my very nature. Harmony is my purpose and my goal. I seek serene people, places, and experiences. My soul feels at home everywhere as the peace of my heart flows outward to bless everyone it touches. And from The Bright Side, quotes to inspire and empower by the editors of Guideposts. God has a plan in the storms of life, but we don't always know what it is. That's the part that requires faith. We reach for a plan, but Jesus offers his hand instead of a map. Bonnie Gray, writer. The only way we can get by in this world is through the help we receive from others. No one can do it alone. Amy Poehler, actor. My mom has been telling me since I was a kid, it's not about proving others wrong, it's about proving yourself right. Stephen Curry, NBA great. The point of life is connection with God, with our own hearts, and with the people God puts in our distinctive corner of the world. Jenny Allen, writer. Gratitude is the grace that makes the blessings flow. LeVar Burton, actor and TV host. God's word is a lamp, but not a flood lamp, more like a flashlight. God's word illuminates one step at a time because that's all we really need to see and know. Tracy Wild Pace, pastor. Happiness is not having the best of everything, but the ability to make the best of anything. Brianna Wiest, author. God designed us each unique like a fingerprint with specific good works that only we can accomplish. Mandisa, gospel singer. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Sony Cantrell Smith's monthly column, Healing Our Way to Oneness. Become who you came here to be, inner work and outer action. As a child, I gathered my dolls, lined them up in imagined pews, and preached to them. I had no idea then that this innocent play was more than a child's game. It was the first whisper of a calling, a hazy foreshadowing of a deeper purpose. Over time, guided by the philosophy and teachings of Science of Mind, I began to sense that unconscious stir. I surrendered to it, and what had once been imaginative play blossomed into a lifelong journey of spiritual growth, awakened inner awareness, heartfelt service, and conscious living. I learned a profound lesson. Becoming who we came here to be is never about arriving at some final fixed state. Instead, life is a continuous unfolding, a steady journey. We are always evolving, always expanding, and we are never done. Inner awareness, the ground of becoming. Transformation begins within, in the quiet space of awareness, by paying attention to our thoughts, feelings, sensations, relationships, and daily events. We root ourselves in being present. We learn to observe without judgment the patterns of our inner life. In the worldview of Science of Mind, our connection to universal creative intelligence, to what Ernest Holmes calls universal mind, is real and accessible. Science of Mind teaches that the universal mind contains all knowledge. It is the potential ultimate of all things. To it, all things are possible. Through inner awareness, through aligning our consciousness with that deeper reality, we tap into our limitless creative potential. Our lives are not mechanical or predetermined. They are living expressions of an infinite field of possibility. Awareness is not passive. It is an active tuning, a willingness to become the observer of our inner world. We can clear the windows of our minds and allow inspiration, insight, and guidance to shine through. From a grounded and conscious inner place, we can choose to live intentionally. Keep in mind that genuine transformation demands vulnerability. It requires humility and the courage to be seen as we are, with our strengths, flaws, grief, wounds, and hopes. Becoming is not about crafting an outer image of perfection. It's about allowing our inner reality to emerge, whole and messy, a tapestry of light and shadow. We can stop chasing a false, perfect self. We surrender the idea that spiritual growth means being flawless. Instead, we embrace our real, evolving humanity. This process of inner integration, of acknowledging and holding all parts of ourselves, clears the way for authenticity. Our thoughts, beliefs, and emotional patterns begin to shift. And as Holmes taught, whatever the mind holds to and firmly believes in forms a new pattern of thought. Inner shift to outer action, serving, healing, creating. The inner journey isn't meant to remain internal. Deep changes in consciousness naturally draw us outward. When we cultivate love, integrity, compassion, and clarity within, we cannot possibly keep those qualities hidden. They push us into expression, into action. We are drawn towards service, kindness, justice, healing, community building, and social responsibility. In living this, we become vessels of spirit, conscious co-creators with the divine, contributing to a world rooted in unity, dignity, compassion, and healing. Our spiritual values, awareness, love, and clarity show up in moments of quiet contemplation, as well as in how we treat others, how we respond to suffering and stand for dignity and equity. The journey isn't just personal growth. It becomes collective transformation, a flowering of compassion and healing across our relationships, communities, and the world. We don't have to wait to be whole. We don't need to perfect ourselves before we serve and love. We only need to show up as we are and allow our inner life to shape our outer reality. The seed you sensed as a child, the quiet imaginative stir, was never meant for you alone. It was meant for all of us. Our journey is shared with all on our path. By living from the heart, by expressing inner knowing outwardly, we live more authentically. Let us walk side by side, embracing our imperfections with kindness, remaining open and curious in every step of our growth. May we become who we came here to be by surrendering to our true essence, letting love flow through every gesture and word. Let each moment reflect the light of our hearts and affirm that our lives become soft offerings of love made visible. Remember, life is always unfolding, and so are we. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Roger Julien, The Nature of Amazing Grace. This is a beautiful thought, that we are fed from the table of the universe, whose board is ever spread with blessedness and peace, whose loving kindness has never been fathomed, whose grace and truth are the cornerstones of reality. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 496. The hymn Amazing Grace is undoubtedly one of the most beloved and most performed songs in the religious hymnal. It is performed at almost every funeral and memorial service, as well as at many other religious and civic services. The lyrics were composed in 1772 by Englishman John Newton, a former slave ship captain who transported captives from Africa to the British colonies in the New World under horrific conditions. Newton experienced conversion during a violent Atlantic storm in which his ship was in danger of sinking. Subsequently, he left the slave trade, entered the English clergy, and composed hymns, many of which we still sing to this day. Grace has been part of Christian theology since the early centuries of the Common Era. Scholars during the Middle Ages gave the term several diverse definitions with varying degrees of complexity. Thankfully, Science of Mind founder Ernest Holmes simplified many of these theological concepts, including grace, which he defines in the glossary of the Science of Mind textbook, "Grace is the givingness of spirit to its creation." Simply put, the definition signifies that God, spirit, the universe, is present in every aspect of creation. As our primary core concept, we simply say, God is all there is. And in that short phrase, we include everything in nature, the universe, and every aspect of our human existence. There is nothing in our experience that is not infused with and ordained by God. We and everything that happens to us are created out of the fullness of divinity. All of this is the effect of grace, given freely at all times. The wonder of grace is that it is given to us totally unearned, without any kind of effort or exertion on our part, without any begging or pleading, without any sense of bargaining for or earning it. It is made available to us all the time and everywhere, and it is given to all of us without regard to status or moral stature. As we read in Matthew 5:45, He makes His sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. Our response to this divine beneficence can only be one of overwhelming gratitude. This expression of gratitude comes forth at every instant from every part of creation in ways that are beyond our comprehension. As Meister Eckhart said, if the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, it will be enough. The problem, the resolution, the grace. Try this experiment on yourself. Think back to a time in your life when you faced a major issue that needed to be dealt with. It could have been anything from the death of a loved one to the ending of a relationship, the loss of a job, or a serious health challenge. At the time, the issue may have seemed unsolvable or impossible to deal with, and the opinions of others were of little help. Then project yourself a few days, weeks, or months ahead to a point at which an answer either came to you, the resolution to the problem became evident, or you determined how to best handle the issue. This resolution may have come to you in a word spoken to you by a friend, something you heard on the radio or television, comments made in passing that seemed inconsequential at the time, or any number of other ways in which Spirit works to provide us with answers. These answers or inspirations are the workings of grace within our limited human experience. We open ourselves to the action of grace by consciously affirming that Spirit is present in the moment and is working with us to provide all we need so we can understand the situation and deal effectively with it. This is not an unrealistic panacea, but an absolute promise made to us by the divine, a promise we can see unfolding in creation at every moment. Imagine, if you will, a blade of grass growing from a tiny seed, nourished in the ground, that develops a beautiful leaf that springs forth from the earth. Who taught the blade of grass how to do that? Who implanted the intelligence of the growing process in the cells of that tiny plant and directed it to spring forth? Can we not depend on the same divine beneficence to care for all of us and our issues? As Jesus asked us in commenting on the lilies of the field, are we not greater than these? Grace is present and active in all of these events, and it is working in us at every moment to support us in navigating our lives and fulfilling our roles in the creative process. Grace as human interaction. The story of Joseph in the book of Genesis is a great example of grace in action. Joseph was one of the youngest sons of Jacob, and from birth, his father doted on him. We all know the story of Joseph and how he compared himself to his brothers, and how Jacob's giving him a special coat, immortalized on the stage as the Technicolor Dreamcoat, caused a great deal of animosity among the brothers. Ultimately, the brothers determined to get rid of Joseph and were dissuaded from killing him and instead sold him to a passing trading caravan, which transported him to Egypt. Several years passed, during which Joseph encountered many setbacks and eventually was imprisoned. While in prison, he came to Pharaoh's attention and was able to interpret Pharaoh's dreams of a period of plenty, followed by a period of famine for the country of Egypt. Pharaoh was so impressed that he placed Joseph in charge of preparing Egypt during the years of plenty and assisting the country during the years of famine. Just as the famine occurred in many other countries, it affected Jacob and his large family and retinue in Israel. Jacob commissioned a few of his sons to go to Egypt and purchase much-needed food and grain. When the brothers arrived, they were brought before Joseph. They did not recognize him, but they knew he exercised absolute power. Joseph, however, did recognize them and acceded to their request, but asked them to return to Israel and bring their father and brothers with them so he could meet them. The brothers returned home with their goods and found that Joseph had included all the money they had brought with them in their baggage. they felt compelled to return to Egypt with their father and brothers. When they entered Joseph's presence at court, he could no longer contain himself and broke down weeping, which surprised the Egyptians since they were unaware of his connection with the party in front of him. Eventually, Joseph revealed himself, saying, "I am Joseph, your brother." When the brothers finally recovered from their shock and amazement, they expressed great incredulity that Joseph could treat them so well when they had treated him so poorly and actually thought he had died. They asked Joseph how he could be so generous with them when they had done so much evil to him. Then Joseph uttered those beautiful words, "What you meant for evil, God meant for good." This is truly an example of grace in action. This should be the hallmark of God's grace in our lives and what that grace should mean to us. Whatever we encounter, whatever happens to us, whatever issue befalls us, God's spirits, the universe's love and grace are always there for us. The givingness of God never ceases, never gives up, is never exhausted, and continues its work in our lives from the first moment of our conception to the last breath we take and beyond. That's why it is so amazing. This should be an encouragement to us when we face what appear to be obstacles of whatever kind or difficulty. The grace of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is always present and always working within us. The givingness of Spirit is infinite. It can and will carry us through any issues we may face. This is amazing grace. And we turn now to the March-April 2026 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Johnny Inez, "Sacred Journeys, How Belize Became My Path to Freedom." Landing in a foreign country with only $500 and no real plan led to a crash course in following inner guidance and trusting the universe. The pull was undeniable. I had two vivid dreams, 2 years apart, both showing me in Belize. The first dream lingered in my mind for a year, feeling like a sign and a message I couldn't ignore. But when I had the second dream, I knew these weren't just random fantasies. They felt like a call from something greater, urging me toward a journey I wasn't sure I was ready to take. At the time, I was struggling to make ends meet. After losing my job due to COVID, I turned my passions and hobbies into small income streams. They helped cover the basics, but I knew I needed more to truly thrive. My dream was to achieve real financial freedom that would allow me to build a life that genuinely fulfilled me. However, the way forward felt frustratingly unclear. Before I knew it, my life began to both fall apart and come together in new ways at the same time. I felt an intense need to let go of my comfort zone, belongings, and attachments that no longer served me. Doors were closing one after another, leaving me with fewer options to stay where I was. But at the same time, the path to Belize was becoming crystal clear, as if the universe was saying, "This is where you need to go." Excitement pulsed beneath my fear. I knew that I was being called to do something, and I was ready to go for it, fear and all. So I booked a one-way ticket and said yes to the call. A new beginning. On March 16, 2022, I arrived in Belize with just over $500, my tarot reading skills, and my combo medicine kit. I'd received extensive training performing this Amazonian ritual and had worked closely with it for 7 years. I was ready to be of service, which in hindsight feels almost laughable. I'd set the intention to build financial stability, but I had no real plan. It was backward, I know, but something inside me knew all would be well. As soon as I landed, the tests began. The first hit was a rapid COVID test. I hadn't been able to get one before leaving the United States, so I had to have the test upon arrival in Belize. It was $25, not much, but the expense still made me anxious. I've always had a complicated relationship with money. Growing up in scarcity, I watched my family struggle to make ends meet, and that fear of lack stayed with me into adulthood. So I paid for the test and tried my best to push down the panic. Then I needed to reach the house where I'd be staying. A friend of a friend had offered me a free place in Plasencia, but I still needed to cover the cost of the short flight from Belize City. When I went to pay, I realized I'd left my credit card in the ATM earlier. Fortunately, a security guard helped me arrange a nearby hotel while I waited for the bank to retrieve my card the next day. But by that point, I was already emotionally triggered and ended up breaking down in tears in the back of the shuttle on my way to the hotel. A bit of relief came that evening when a friend booked an online tarot reading with me. The extra cash was a small but welcome relief. The next day, credit card in hand, I booked the flight and landed in Plasencia. The turquoise water stretched endlessly beneath me, and for a moment I thought, maybe this won't be so bad after all. But just a week into my trip, reality hit. I was spending more than I was making. My old financial fears started to resurface, and the uncertainty felt overwhelming. While I knew I needed to be careful with my money, I craved adventure. When I saw a flyer for a midnight jungle tour, $120, a significant chunk of my remaining funds, I felt torn. Clinging to my money would keep me safe, but it also meant staying confined to my comfort zone, missing out on experiences I truly desired. It was a reckless decision, but something inside me urged me to go for it. So, despite the fear, I said yes. Walking through the Belizean jungle under the stars, I felt like I was tapping into something ancestral. The creatures, the sounds, the complete stillness of the night, it all felt so magical. At one point, we floated down a river in inner tubes, the only light coming from our headlamps and the stars. At that moment, I thought, I'm so glad I did this, so glad I spent the money. It was as if I had finally stepped into the life I'd always dreamed of, one of complete freedom and adventure, a life I never thought I could have. By the time I returned, it was nearly 3 a.m., but I was buzzing with energy. I just knew I made the right choice. Days later, it was time to leave my little bungalow in Belize. I had nothing to return to in the United States, so my only option was to move forward on this journey. By this point, I had maybe $100 left. I felt panic, but instead of spiraling, I listened to a voice inside me that whispered, Tulum. Traveling 340 miles to a resort town on Mexico's Yucatan coast didn't make sense. I had barely enough money to survive, but my intuition had guided me this far, so I packed my bags and found a direct bus from Belize City to Tulum. By 6 a.m. the next morning, I was on a bus, trusting that the universe would continue to support and guide me. Trust and Tulum. By the time I reached Tulum, I had just $12 left, barely enough for a meal and a room for the night. With every step, I had to let go of fear and leaned into faith. But now I found myself questioning why I'd been called to take this path in the first place. What followed was nothing short of transformative. I spent an entire year in Mexico, traveling across the country and embracing experiences I once thought were impossible. I swam in crystal clear cenotes, natural limestone pools fed by underground springs, wandered through lush jungles, and connected with vibrant local communities. Each moment helped me chip away at old patterns of fear and self-doubt so I could create a life rooted in freedom and abundance. During my long bus ride to Tulum, I had time to reflect on how I had viewed money. I had treated it as something scarce, holding on tightly out of fear. This mindset had kept me stuck, constantly worrying about the what-ifs. I had to actively practice shifting these beliefs. It wasn't easy. Fear doesn't just disappear overnight. But here I was, traveling through foreign lands with barely a dollar to my name, and yet every step of the way I was supported. The universe placed the right people in my path and presented opportunities to provide what I needed as long as I was open to receiving. The more I let go of fear, the more abundance flowed to me. For example, when I first arrived in Tulum, I took a volunteer gig at the hostel where I was staying. One day, I checked in a couple who, to my surprise, quickly became my closest friends. When I opened up to them about my journey, they didn't hesitate to support me. It was beyond my comprehension that people I had just met would be so generous. We traveled together during my time in Mexico, and to this day, they remain my best friends. There was also a turning point when I overcame my fears of putting myself out there. I began hosting medicine ceremonies and offering tarot readings in the streets of San Cristobal and on the beaches of Mazunte. It was a big step in building my confidence, and even more important, I learned to trust that people would value what I had to offer. I also let go of my fear of asking for help, and because of that, so many friends and family showed up to support me financially, helping me not just survive, but truly thrive on my journey. Every day I faced and dismantled my old fears, replacing them with a belief in limitless possibility. I knew without a doubt that the universe would provide, whether the plan was clear or not. With that trust came the deep knowing that abundance was my birthright, and thriving was no longer just a dream, it was my reality. Colombia calling. By March 2023, my time in Mexico felt complete, and I began searching for flights to Guatemala. As I scanned my options, a conversation outside my window caught my attention. Two women were talking, and when one of them mentioned Colombia, the word stood out so clearly as if it had been said just for me. In that instant, something within me lit up. Guatemala, which had seemed like the logical next step, no longer felt right, but there was something so magnetic about Colombia. Without a clear plan, I decided to go. Almost 2 years later, I'm still in Colombia, continuing to build upon the foundation I set in motion. The lessons around money are still coming, but fear no longer controls me. Now, I pursue my desires with unshakable passion, knowing the universe has my back. In retrospect, I see that every challenge, every uncomfortable moment, and every adventure was not just a test, but also a crucial part of my transformation. This journey, one that pushed me to break free from old beliefs and step into abundance, had been mine to choose, and Belize was just the beginning. We pause for a moment to remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We continue now with the book we've been reading from the past few weeks, The Light Between Us, Stories from Heaven, Lessons for the Living by Laura Lynn Jackson. And we had just started chapter 16, Forever Family. And we left the book when Bob and Fran, parents of a child in an accident, Bob and Fran got the idea that maybe in that mysterious space where life and dreams intersect, some measure of solace might be found for grieving parents like them. Maybe the whole story of their daughter's life and death, so far an unacceptably simple story, in which beautiful Bailey was here one day and gone the next, had yet to be told. So they read books about psychic phenomena. They went to see mediums. They opened their minds to a new way of looking at everything. All that digging led to one inescapable conclusion. There is an unseen world, Bob says, and we were meant to work with it. Bob and Fran teamed up with Dr. Gary E. Schwartz, professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery, and the director of the Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health at the University of Arizona, and co-founded the Forever Family Foundation. Through it, they would help grieving people by trying to connect them with the loved ones they had lost, building a bridge between this world and the next. It would be Bailey's Bridge. In 2005, I contacted the FFF and said I was a psychic medium interested in volunteering my services. The first requirement, I was told, was to pass a rigorous certification test. It involved doing several readings in quick succession while being scored for accuracy. On a hot August day, I found myself, along with four other mediums, in a conference room in a hotel on Long Island. A couple of the other mediums seemed to know each other, which made me feel like the new kid on the first day of school. I wasn't friends with any psychic mediums, and I wasn't part of any psychic medium community. There were very few people I could talk to about my gift. We were led into a large ballroom where the tests were held. A middle-aged man was brought in and seated in front of all the mediums. We were asked to read him silently for 15 minutes and write down what came through on a legal pad. I was nervous. I'd never been asked to read in public, and I certainly had never had my reading scored. I focused hard on the man and scribbled down everything that came through. When the 15 minutes were up, an FFF staffer told us the man's name was Tom. The woman sitting next to me elbowed me excitedly. "Check this out," she said, pointing to her legal pad. On it, she had written Tom. I smiled politely. All I'd gotten was that his name began with T. Still, something in that brief exchange with the woman, I learned she was a psychic medium named Kim Russo, calmed me down. It felt like we were there in the trenches together. Maybe even peers. That strange feeling of camaraderie was oddly comforting. Next, we were moved to one of five stations set up in separate alcoves, each with a video camera capturing the results. At each station, there was a sitter holding a clipboard. The sitter was not allowed to talk to us. He or she could only say yes or no. Once the readings began, the mediums would be given 15 minutes to read each sitter before being rotated to the next station for another 15-minute reading. The sitters would score our readings for accuracy. That part of the test, through all five stations, would take 75 minutes. Nervously, I sat down at the first station and took a deep breath. Then I looked at the woman across from me, the sitter. I swam into the space between us and linked my energy with hers and with the other side. The nervousness went away. I stopped thinking about who I was or what I was doing. I just listened to the other side and shared what those there were saying. The woman's father came through, and then her aunt and maternal grandmother. They gave me dates that were important to her family. They showed me how family members had crossed. They brought up the work she was currently having done on her house. The other side poured out information, and before I knew it, it was time to move to the next sitter. By the third sitter, I felt completely open to the other side. I was reading for a woman who appeared to be in her 40s. Her son came through immediately. He gave me his name and told me he had passed in a car accident. Then he did something strange. He showed me the date of my daughter Ashley's birthday, which is May 16th. "Did your son cross on May 16th?" I asked the sitter. Her face went pale and her lip trembled. Her eyes filled with tears. "Yes," she said. Her son started making jokes from the other side. He brought up funny family stories. Through her tears, the woman laughed, and so did I. I didn't want to leave her when our time was up. The next sitter, a woman in her early 30s, had also lost a son. He told me his name was Michael and that he had passed from cancer. He showed me 3 years on a timeline, which meant he'd crossed 3 years ago, and he, too, made his mother laugh by talking about his pickiness with food. Then he thanked her for the love she had shown him while he was here. "That was his lesson," I explained, "to feel your unconditional love. That was why he was here, and he completed that lesson. He says to tell you he always felt safe, even when he was crossing. He crossed surrounded by your love." I read for one more person, and then the test was complete. The video cameras were turned off, the clipboards put down. I was exhausted. I felt that I'd done well in the readings, and I realized I'd learned something new. I was amazed by the son who informed me of his crossing date by showing me Ashley's birthday. Somehow, he'd been able to use my own frame of reference in order to pass on the message. I realized that the other side has access to every thought, every moment, every intimate detail of my life, and that those there will use that access to pass along messages and validations to their loved ones. Fran told us we would hear from the FFF in a few weeks with the results. We learned the sitters in front of us were professional sitters, people who'd been trained not to reveal anything during readings, to root out tricks and gimmicks and fraudulent readings. I milled around the conference room and found myself next to Kim Russo and another psychic medium, Bobby Allison. Kim and Bobby were already friends. They were both around my age, pretty smart, and completely down to earth. I loved their energy. We chatted about the test and compared notes, letting go of our nervousness. Our conversation was casual. It felt like three friends talking. "Who's your teacher?" Bobby asked me. "My teacher?" I said. "I don't have a teacher." Kim and Bobby looked shocked. I didn't realize until that moment that not having a teacher or mentor was unusual. They told me about their mentors and how they'd helped guide them to explore their gifts further. They spoke of their teachers with great love and admiration, as if they couldn't have become who they were without them. We made plans to get together, and a couple of weeks later met for dinner at a restaurant near where we lived. We picked up right where we left off. Each of us told a story of when we first realized we were different. Kim explained how she'd close her eyes to go to sleep and receive visions of people she didn't know. "I was seeing dead people in my bedroom when I was 9, she said. Bobby told us how her grandmother, mother, and 3 sisters were all psychic. "I was always reading people," she said. "People began to call me Miss Know-It-All. Even my family got fed up. They'd tell me they were going to leave me at home when they went out because I always spoiled things with all my knowing." My dinner with Kim and Bobby was exhilarating. I felt a lightness of spirit that I hadn't felt in a long time, if ever. We bounced ideas off each other, compared techniques, and even read for each other. It was just like any 3 girlfriends giving each other advice, only the advice was coming from the other side. This bonding was meaningful for each of us. "It's hard to keep yourself balanced with all the readings," Bobby said at one point. "You have to find your balance, and being with friends who have the same energy is how I stay balanced." I knew what she was talking about. We all had the same fears and problems. We all needed a safe place just to be ourselves. Before that night, I'd felt like I was out there by myself. Now, though, I had a kind of psychic family. We would go on to meet for dinner once a month to talk, laugh, sympathize, and support. I had a sisterhood now. I had a safe place. A few weeks after the certification test, I got a call from Fran Ginsberg. She explained how my test had been graded, how each sitter provided numerical scores that were used to calculate my accuracy. Fran said my scores were high, meaning that my readings had been exceptionally accurate. "Congratulations," she said. "You are now certified." I felt my heart race and my eyes well up. I was approved to participate in FFF-sponsored events. I'd found the outlet I needed to take my abilities to the next level. I felt the pull to help people who were grieving, and now I'd get the chance to do it. Being certified by the FFF was a powerful validation for me, but it was more than that. It was also a galvanizing moment. It was a call to action. I was now part of something greater than myself. I was part of a team of light. I had the feeling my life as a psychic medium was about to change. Chapter 17, More Things in Heaven and Earth. Ashley had just turned 5 when Garrett and I decided it was the right time to have another baby. We had always wanted another child, but felt we needed to wait a bit. Our lives were hectic, often chaotic, with Garrett finishing law school and then studying for the bar exam, and with me as a new mom, a new teacher, and a psychic medium on the side. In time, things began to settle down. Garrett passed the bar, and I received tenure as a teacher. We were able to scrimp and save and buy a 1-story, 3-bedroom home on a quiet, tree-lined street on Long Island. I told the universe I was ready. It was baby time. But when I didn't get pregnant immediately, I began to question the universe. Was this meant to happen now or not? To help things along, I went to my local pharmacy to buy an over-the-counter ovulation predictor. I took Ashley with me. I found myself in an aisle surrounded by 2 walls of pregnancy tests, ovulation predictors, and all sorts of baby-making products. I felt overwhelmed. I started thinking that I might not get pregnant and felt bereft. I was giving in to my fears. I did my best to hide my feelings from Ashley, but inside, I was a wreck. Just then, Ashley tugged on my shirt. "Mommy," she said, "do you know Fuzzle is lying right by your feet now, giving you love?" "Fuzzle?" Fuzzle had been our family dog when I was a little girl. She was a beautiful, affectionate West Highland White Terrier, and I loved her like crazy. Fuzzle always comforted me and gave me love when I needed it. She was loyal beyond belief. When we went on family vacations, Fuzzle would snuggle on top of one of our suitcases the night before so we wouldn't forget to take her. I adored Fuzzle like any girl adores her first pet, and I vowed to keep her with me in my heart forever. But even so, it's not like I thought about Fuzzle all the time. After all, she'd crossed nearly 2 decades before. I was sure I'd mentioned her to Ashley, and she may have even seen a photo of her, but honestly, Fuzzle didn't come up all that often in our daily lives. And now, my 5-year-old daughter was telling me Fuzzle was curled up at my feet in the pregnancy aisle of the drugstore? Immediately, I knew it was true. I'd already had suspicions that Ashley possessed some of the same gifts as I did. So I wasn't all that surprised she could see Fuzzle, but I was overcome with emotion that Fuzzle would show up with a message of love just when I needed it. All my doubts and fears about getting pregnant vanished in that moment. I had the strong sensation that everything would be fine. 1 month later, I was pregnant. Being pregnant again filled me with joy and energy. 9 months later, a beautiful baby boy arrived in the world with a crown of shining platinum blonde hair. He seemed to glow. We named him Hayden. I expected the months after his birth to be busy and draining and difficult, but also happy and glorious, just as they had been after Ashley was born. But this time it was different. Instead of feeling elated, I felt depressed, anxious, and pulled down by negative energy. It wasn't Hayden's fault. He was a sweet, buoyant little baby. It was just something the pregnancy did to my internal wiring. I felt swings of energy and emotion, like living in a house where the thermostat went from hot to cold to hot. At times, it felt like a cloud of darkness was hovering over me. Was it postpartum depression? My symptoms certainly matched the diagnosis. Sadness, anxiety, irritability, crying episodes, disrupted sleep. But I also had another frightening symptom. I began to have dark thoughts. It wasn't that I'd ever do something bad and harmful. God knows I never would. It was that I realized I could. And no matter how hard I tried to will positive thoughts to blot out the negative ones, I couldn't overcome them. The dark thoughts just wouldn't stop. It was terrifying. "This isn't me," I told myself over and over. "I work in the light, not the dark. I don't even watch scary movies." A familiar feeling came roaring back. "What if I'm crazy?" I had to face the reality that something might seriously be wrong with me, just as I'd suspected for most of my life. All the progress I'd made toward accepting my abilities, toward finding my place in the world, was suddenly at risk. It was a painful, agonizing time. I decided to seek help and made an appointment to see a psychiatrist. When I walked into Dr. Mark Reitman's office, I was a bundle of raw nerves. Would talk about the other side make me appear psychotic? Might Dr. Reitman find me unfit to take care of my children? His manner quickly put me at ease. His energy was soft and gentle and loving. Still, I feared the worst. I began by telling him about my terrifying thoughts. I held nothing back. Dr. Reitman listened quietly, betraying no emotion or judgment. When I was done, he asked me a simple question. I know you have these dark thoughts, but do you think you would ever actually act on them? He asked. I didn't hesitate. Absolutely not, I said. Not in a million years. I would never, ever do anything like that. Okay, then, Dr. Reitman said. I felt relieved, but I knew I had to tell him the rest. That's not all, I said. I told him about how I knew my grandfather was going to die when I was 11, about the dream I had about John, about how I felt people's energy and saw them in colors, about how I talk to the dead and how they respond, about how they have me pass along messages to their loved ones. Dr. Reitman listened stoically. I dreaded his answer. Let me ask you something, Laura, he asked calmly. When you do these readings, do you get accurate information? Does it help people? Oh, yes, I told him. I get names and dates and all sorts of validating details, and the messages are always about healing and love. The readings are beautiful. I learn so much from them myself. I love being part of them. Dr. Reitman smiled and looked me in the eye. I don't think you're crazy, he said. You should not think of these things as symptoms of anything. You should see them as skills you need to explore. The universe is bigger than we know. In those few words, those magical healing words, I heard the beautiful echo of my beloved William Shakespeare, who through Hamlet said, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." I felt free. My biggest fear that I was crazy, delusional, was lifted. It felt like I had passed some kind of psychological test. Dr. Reitman addressed the symptoms of my postpartum depression. He devised a treatment plan that began with putting me on medication to help me deal with the mood swings and dark thoughts. The problem was, I don't metabolize medicine in the way most people do. I have an extremely low tolerance for any kind of drug. Even a tablet of ibuprofen can make me feel weak and out of whack, but we agreed to try it. Within a few weeks, I found the medicine wasn't helping me with the mood swings. It was also interfering with my abilities. Instead of the fast flow of information I normally got during a reading, what I was getting now was more of a steady drip. Dr. Reitman decided to try me on a natural mood balancer called SAM-E. That did the trick. The dark thoughts evaporated like a heavy fog being burned off by the sun. The natural flow of information from the other side returned. In fact, it intensified, just as it had after Ashley's birth. I stayed on SAM-E for a number of months until I felt fully balanced, but just as important as Dr. Reitman's treatment of my postpartum symptoms was his acceptance of my gift. There was nothing in his training as a psychiatrist that touched on the supernatural, but it was my good fortune that he was open to things not found in psychiatric texts. I went to see Dr. Reitman several times in the months that followed. I felt safe and free to discuss my abilities with him, and the more we talked, the less unsure and isolated I felt. Was I just lucky to find a psychiatrist with such a curious, non-judgmental mind? I don't think it was luck. The other side, it seemed, was always putting special people in my path, people who were meant to help me understand and honor my abilities. Dr. Reitman was one of them. Chapter 18, The Policeman's Cap. With my energy and my abilities rebalanced, I was ready to do readings again. Around that time, I got a call from Fran Ginsberg at the Forever Family Foundation inviting me to participate in a special event called How to Listen When Your Children Speak. 10 sets of parents who had lost a child would be there, along with one psychic medium. Me. I swallowed hard and told Fran I'd do it. The event was scheduled for the last week in August. In the weeks leading up to it, I felt my anxiety escalating. It was like an internal buzzing that got louder and louder until it was nearly unbearable. I spent a lot of time talking to the other side, asking them to please be there and give me messages for these grieving families. This event was unlike anything I'd experienced. I'd have to walk into a room with nothing but my inner screen. No plan B, no other medium to pick up the slack should the other side fail to come through for me. I would have to trust the other side completely. I spent the week before the event with my children, enjoying the last days of summer. Hayden, who was 16 months, and Ashley, then 7, kept me busy and took my mind off the event. Still, when the day of the event arrived, I was more nervous than ever. The buzzing was at a fever pitch. I tried to eat, but I could barely keep food down. I skipped dinner altogether. Garrett was working as an in-house attorney for a large retail chain, and he wasn't due home until 6:30. My mom came over to babysit until he got home. I kissed the kids, thanked my mom, and climbed into my Honda Pilot. I called Garrett from the car, and once again he assured me I'd be fine. When we hung up, I focused on my breathing. Breathe in, breathe out. Find your center. Connect with your spiritual self. And then, on Jericho Turnpike, the children came. I pulled off the road and screeched into the Staples parking lot. I took out a little notebook I keep in my purse and wrote down as much as I could of what the children were saying. Even as it was happening, I could hardly believe it. I'd never been so barraged by messages from the other side before. After a few minutes, I got back on Jericho Turnpike and raced to the Huntington Hilton. I got to the event just in time. The parents were already seated in the conference room, yet it was eerily quiet. It seemed airless. I could feel the heaviness all around me. "This is Laura Lynn Jackson," Bob Ginsburg told the parents. "She's a certified medium with the Forever Family Foundation, and she's here tonight to help us learn how to talk to our children." Bob and Franz slipped out of the room to give the parents as much privacy as possible. As soon as they left, everyone's attention turned back to me. As a teacher, I was used to people staring at me and waiting for me to talk, but this was different. The silence was excruciating. I had to do something. I had to start talking, but I didn't know what to say. Then I realized that all I needed to do was let the children talk, and all at once I felt them rush in. "Your children are here," I blurted out, "and there's something they want you to know." Without even noticing it, I had slipped into that place that is just slightly above the level of my head, the place where I cease to inhabit my physical body and become my spiritual self, where I am no longer the me I know, and where I can let go of my earthly concerns. I felt a click and a door opening. The children appeared as points of light on my inner screen. They came through clearly and strongly, and it was exhilarating. I was surrounded by these beautiful kids with all their beautiful energy. "Your children are all here together around you now," I told the parents, "and collectively they have a message they want you to hear. They are saying, please don't worry about us. We're fine. We are okay. Put your fears and worries aside so we can have this time together. There's so much we want you to know." I sensed that these words cut right through the tension in the room. Some of the heaviness lifted. I understood why the children had come to me before the event in my car. They knew their parents would have their guard up. They knew their parents had built walls around themselves to block out the pain and grief and rage. The children knew those walls could keep them from being heard, so they came to me with a common message for all the parents. Take down the walls. Let down your guard so we can come through. Don't be afraid or confused or resistant. Please know we are here with you, beside you, right now. These children, so vibrant and so full of light, were inviting us to swim in their happy energy. I felt nothing but pure love. No fear, no pain, no guilt, just love. It's like when you're waiting at the airport for someone you dearly love, and all of a sudden, that person turns a corner and you see him or her walking toward you, and it's just the best feeling in the world. That's how I felt in that conference room. I felt embraced by love. This time, to my surprise, the children lined up patiently, one by one, instead of overwhelming me as they had in the car. I wasn't dictating the order of events. They were. I sensed a child coming through and felt a strong pull. I call it an energy lasso, the feeling of the other side guiding my body toward a couple at the far end of the conference table. The man was stoic, refusing to let any emotion play on his face. His wife sat close to him, but did not touch him. She was already crying. The child coming through was a teenage girl. She showed me she was an only child in order to acknowledge the particular grief her parents felt when she passed. She showed me the letter J, but she also showed me a short word, as if to say she went by a nickname. "Your child is coming through," I said to her parents. "Your daughter. She's showing me a J name, but she went by something else. Jessica or Jennifer, but you called her something else." Her parents nodded slowly. "Her name was Jessica, but they called her Jessie." Then Jessie showed me what happened to her. "It started in her chest," I said. Later, I would learn the whole story from her parents. On the morning of Good Friday, 2007, Jessie, a high school sophomore, came down the stairs of her family's home in Falls River, Connecticut. She told her parents, I feel sick. Jessie, there's no school today, her father Joe said. You don't have to pretend to be sick. No, I really am, she said. I really don't feel well. Just the day before, Jessie had played in a lacrosse game and gone to a training session with the state police's Explorer Club for teens. Two of her many passions. Smart and pretty, with red hair, freckles, and a warm, shy smile, Jessie never slowed down. By 15, she was already an honor student, a second-degree black belt, and a certified scuba diver. She loved her friends, her family, and her golden retriever, Paladin, Pal for short, and she had a great curiosity about life. She was turning 16 in 2 weeks, and she just started seeing her first boyfriend. Nothing serious, her mother Marianne said. She just told me, Mom, I love someone, like teenagers do. Joe and Marianne drove Jessie to her pediatrician, who said she had the flu. That night, Jessie coughed up blood, and her parents took her to a hospital. The next day, an ambulance rushed her to another medical center, and from there, Jessie was airlifted to the Children's Hospital in Boston. She did have the flu, but it was a rare and virulent strain. Quickly, the flu turned into pneumonia, then sepsis. Jessie's vital signs were weakening, and she was put on a respirator because her lungs were so damaged. Friends and relatives drove to Boston to be with Joe and Marianne, while others stayed behind and held a candlelight vigil in Jessie's backyard. Then, just 5 days after she came down the stairs on Good Friday, a CAT scan revealed Jessie had bleeding in her brain. The doctor said there was nothing they could do. Joe, a burly man who works in an auto body shop, and Marianne, a strong Catholic woman, went numb. Something they didn't even have time to anticipate was suddenly, unimaginably coming to pass. They were losing their beautiful girl. Joe and Marianne went into Jessie's room together to say goodbye. I love you, Marianne told her, stroking her daughter's long red hair. You are our best friend in the world. Joe held tight to Jessie's hand and rubbed the tears out of his eyes so they wouldn't fall on her. I love you, Jessie, he said. I love you so much. Jessie passed away a few days after Easter. And we will continue with this story in the coming weeks. But now, at the end of our program, I wish you a joyous and peaceful and beautiful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.